I'm not sure Israel is so crazy about having America run Gaza. And it interferes to some degree with their own plans, which are, I think, to occupy the whole of Gaza, at least indirectly, and to have undisputed rights to claim the offshore natural gas deposits, which are considerable, apparently.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome to Deep Focus. Before we get into the substance of today's conversation, I want to ask you the favor of subscribing to the podcast, liking, sharing, commenting, talk about it with your friends. It means the world to us, and it helps to trigger that algorithm at YouTube that makes it all so much better and gets word around. I want to start by telling you a very short personal story. I got out of prison in 2015. I served 23 months after blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program, something I would do again today if I had the opportunity. Just after my release from prison, the Greek government hired me to help them write a new whistleblower protection law. And they flew me out to Athens to meet with the Minister of Justice, the Minister of State for Anti-Corruption, and a half a dozen different parliamentarians. But they did it on the cheap. And the cheapest way to get me out to Athens was to fly out through JFK and to fly back to Washington through Toronto. Toronto's in Canada. Well, I went out to Greece, I worked with the government, and I flew back to Toronto. When I got off the plane, or maybe it would be more appropriate to say, as I was getting off the plane, two members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police intercepted me just there at the plane's door and grabbed me by both of my arms. I said, "Hey, what's up?" One of them turned to me and said, "You are not welcome in Canada." I said, "I'm not entering Canada. I'm walking from one plane to another so I can go home to Washington." They didn't say anything else to me the whole time, but they physically pulled me by the arms through the airport with people taking pictures and video. It was all very embarrassing and humiliating, which I think was probably the point. And then they physically walked me onto the connecting plane to Washington. As I sat down and put my seatbelt on, they said, "Don't come back to Canada." That was my last experience with the Canadians. Well, today we're going to talk with a bona fide American hero who we've had on the show before. Professor Richard Falk has been everything I would want to be: the United Nations Special Rapporteur on human rights, a prominent voice in support of human rights around the world, but recently, and specifically, human rights for Palestinians. He's a professor emeritus of law and the co-founder of a very important organization that supports human rights around the world. He also had a recent and difficult experience in Canada. Professor Falk, welcome back to the show. It's so good to see you again.
Thank you so much, John. It's very always good to be your guest.
Thank you. The pleasure, believe me, the pleasure is all mine. Professor, I want to get into, in a few minutes, some of the substantive issues surrounding Gaza and the treatment of Palestinians there, especially Palestinian civilians. But first, I want to talk about what happened to you in Canada. And it just so happened to take place on your 95th birthday. Now, you were accosted in Ottawa at the airport. You had flown in from California. Tell us what happened.
Well, it's sort of a long tale, but an abbreviated version is that they took our passports. I was with my wife, who had also been a UN special rapporteur. And we were led to a sort of a holding area where we waited a half hour. And then they told us to come follow another border security person. And we went to another room where we waited for another half hour or so until this border security agent came and said that he had the obligation of questioning us so that Canada could determine whether I was a security threat to Canada. I'd never been flattered in that way before. I wondered what could have led to this sudden elevation of my status to be a security threat. And it eventually came out that from the questions they posed that they were interested in the event that I was attending, which was a tribunal organized by some young Canadians it was called the Palestinian Tribunal on Canadian Responsibility. And it was devoted for the 2 days that it lasted to a variety of testimonies from either survivors of the Gaza genocide or experts on aspects of the situation. But the net effect was to create the most devastating inquiry into third-party complicity, which, of course, other countries are even more in need of illuminating than Canada was, starting with the U.S., of course, that has been the most stalwart of Israel's supporters and has gone along even with this phony ceasefire that kills numerous Palestinians and yet is still called a ceasefire. I think there are over 200 violations of it in the 40 days it's been in operation. And really, Israel is doing quietly and without international objection what it's been doing in a more accelerated form before the ceasefire went into effect. So it's a very peculiar diplomacy that is emerging, and with a certain degree of UN complicity at this stage, not only the countries that overtly support Israel, but the countries that indirectly do so through their way of filtering the news in their media or by subtle ways of indirectly assisting Israel by encouraging economic relations with their private sector corporations and other means of promoting national economic and political interests.
Professor, let's talk for a second about these violations that we're seeing taking place. Donald Trump said as recently as yesterday, we're recording this on a Friday, November 21st, he said as recently as yesterday that thanks to him, there is peace in Gaza. We all know that's not true. There's a ceasefire, kind of, sort of. But as you noted truthfully, correctly, the Israelis violate it constantly. There have been hundreds of Palestinian civilians killed just since the announcement of the ceasefire. Do you see that changing at all? Is there any reason to be optimistic here that the ceasefire will turn into some sort of a peace?
It's hard to be optimistic about a plan that is another form of 21st century oppression. There's no role for the U.S. or for Europe to play in the governance of Gaza. And yet, this is not only a plan for that kind of controlled governance, but it puts the American president at the head of a so-called board of peace that is given the authority to administer the transition from whatever accelerated genocide occurred for the past 2+ years to some stabilized condition under Western supervision. So it really carries forth out in the open the allegation that the whole Zionist undertaking was a settler colonial imposition on a society that had long been organized around its Arab-Palestinian majority. And this idea of devising what the future of Gaza is on the part of Europeans and North Americans seems historically out of touch with the collapse of European colonialism. It's a kind of zombie colonialism that occurs after, that takes its shape and encounter with the native population after the collapse of European colonialism in other parts of the world, particularly Asia. And so it's a very strange kind of phenomenon that has these original characteristics that are not repeated in other anti-colonial struggles.
Professor, I think just about every non-Israeli observer of the Gaza conflict has come to the conclusion, if they hadn't been there already, that the only way out of this is that there has to be an independent Palestine. The Israelis, of course, have utterly ruled this out. It will never happen, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said just about a week ago, and he has been saying it all of his life. But it seems like there is no other way to do this, that there has to be an independent Palestine, or maybe Palestine is in the West Bank and Gaza has some sort of special administrative status. I know the Israeli press was writing briefly a month or two ago about the idea that perhaps Israel would, quote unquote, own Gaza while the Saudi government would administer it on a day-to-day basis and would invest in it so that they could build a port and an airport and an electrical grid and water desalination facilities and such. Do you see anything like that happening? Is there any stomach among the Israeli political class to allow at least some sort of administrative assistance to Gaza, or more broadly, a path to an independent Palestine?
At this point, I mean, one can't rule out the improbable, because it historically the improbable sometimes occurred. And the most relevant example of that would be the South African turn away from apartheid rather than face this choice between genocide and continued resistance. See, you come to a point in an effort to suppress the native population that it either politically surrenders, which happened to the native peoples in North America by and large, and Australia and New Zealand, or you go to the next stage of repression, which after apartheid is genocide and an ecocidal secondary implications, as in Gaza, which now is a virtual wasteland, where the recent rains have flooded some of the tent communities, and they're forced to live in this condition that would make what we call homelessness be seen as a kind of luxurious lifestyle. And we call that peace, to subject a population to that is physically present in its own homeland, to be victimized in this extreme continuing way, where their homes have been destroyed, where their access to adequate food and medicine has been denied over a long period, where there's no safe drinking water, where electricity is very unstable and unreliable. And all of these aspects have been deliberately manipulated by the IDF and the political leadership of Israel to make the suffering of the Palestinian people as intense as possible. And that seems to make any kind of strategic sense only if the Israeli policy is and has been one of either killing a large number of Palestinians or making conditions of remaining so burdensome that a lot of Palestinians will choose the lesser of evils, which is to become refugees and to leave. And this is an ongoing process. It has not ended with the ceasefire. The ceasefire has, as you earlier said, diminished the drama of 24/7 bombardment and devastation from the air, but it hasn't eliminated a condition of acute suffering and vulnerability, not only to Israeli militarism, but also to conditions that imperil health, particularly of young children, their health and development. So it's really a spectacle of horror that the eyes and ears of the world have been exposed to for many months, less so in the countries supporting Israel, the complicit third-party countries, but still gradually enough of the imagery of atrocity has penetrated Western political consciousness, that one now finds growing tensions between the society and the state over these issues, where the citizenry has a greater moral sensitivity than the elites running the country, that are thinking of very selfish short-term interests and not respecting their own pledge of never again after the Nazi Holocaust. And one now has to reinterpret that from a racist perspective and say the slogan should be never again against a white minority.
You raise a very important point here that that frequently comes up in the Arab press, and that is what appears to be a usually unspoken Israeli policy of ethnic cleansing. And when I say ethnic cleansing, I mean actively encouraging Palestinians to get out. King Abdullah of Jordan and President Sisi of Egypt have both said that they will not take Palestinian refugees, not because their hearts aren't breaking for the Palestinians, but because to do so would further the Israelis' policy of ethnically cleansing Gaza, freeing it of any claim that Palestinians may have to their ancestral land, so they can take it over and develop it and settle it. What's the solution to something like this? You can't just allow people to live in perpetuity in rubble, the rubble of their bombed and destroyed homes. And if other countries won't take them as refugees, can't take them as refugees, then what's the solution there?
I wouldn't call it a solution, but the most disturbing scenario for the future is a continuation of the basic structure of oppression and exploitation, with changing the format to some superficial degree, but from a Palestinian point of view, still excluding them from any kind of participation in shaping their own future, and subjecting them to the ideology of the Israelis that any expression of resistance is a form of terrorism. And that goes against the development of international law in the course of the anti-colonial struggles, which came step by step to the conclusion that there is a human right to resist colonial occupation and colonial policies that are exploitative, and that Palestine is a textbook example of such a structure of domination and exploitation, which has been characterized by the leading international human rights NGOs, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, as a definite form of apartheid, which is an international crime developed in relation to South Africa, but not limited to South African situation. The apartheid convention for the prevention and punishment of apartheid came into force in 1972. So it goes back to the apartheid period, but as I say, it is flexible enough to be applied in the given the facts of Palestinian victimization.
Professor, I was wondering if you might comment a little bit on domestic Israeli politics. The reason I ask is that we've seen what appears on the surface of things to be a very strong Israeli move to the political right, to the point where there are Israeli ministers now like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, the minister of finance, who also is the security minister of the West Bank. These men have felony convictions for anti-Palestinian hate crimes in their pasts. Felony convictions in Israel. Even by Israeli standards, their personal positions were too much for the law to even be able to handle. But there are powerful ministers in the Netanyahu government now. Before October 7th, Israel was experiencing demonstrations the likes of which the country had never seen before, and it looked like the Netanyahu government was going to collapse. Instead, it was able to strengthen by rallying people against the Palestinians. Now, in the West Bank, it looks as though the government may be losing control, not to Palestinians, but to settlers who have been attacking Palestinians, killing them, burning mosques, burning buildings, and the government says that it's powerless to stop them. What are we seeing here in terms of Israeli politics? Has the body politic moved so far to the right that it's out of control or uncontrollable? Or is this a government policy where the Israelis want us to think that they can't control the settlers? Or is Netanyahu really more popular now than he was before October 7th?
Well, you raise a series of very challenging issues that can't be authoritatively answered because there's a lot of uncertainty, some of it deliberate effort to shift attention away from what Israel has done to the Palestinians, partly a way of keeping the Israeli public unified around an anti-Palestinian political agenda. We have to remember that when the Netanyahu coalition government took control in Israel at the beginning of 2023, but 10 months before the Hamas attack, it was already characterized, even by the mainstream Western media, as the most extreme government in the history of Israel. And what made it extreme, in my view, was its only slightly disguised intention to fulfill the Zionist vision of a single state, a one-state outcome, with Israel presiding and the ethnic characteristics of a Jewish supremacist state being embodied in the constitutional structure of the country, which it already is to a certain degree as a result of the 2018 Basic Law, which declared that only the Jewish people have self-determination within the boundaries of Israel-Palestine, that incorporated the occupied territories. So what happened when this coalition, and the reason that the ultra-right got into that leadership role was that Netanyahu otherwise could not have reassumed control over the governing process. In other words, it was his need for partners that, in order to escape his fraud accusations within Israel and assume or reassume control of the government, that forced him into this Faustian bargain with the ultra-right. It didn't depart so much from his own agenda, which was, as you suggest, always denied the willingness of Israel to allow a genuine Palestinian state to come into existence. And what the Netanyahu coalition did, in addition to appointing these religious extremists to very critical cabinet positions, and particularly sensitive ones in relation to the Palestinian issues, what they did was to greenlight violence by the settlers from day one. And they even provided settlers with additional weaponry and played a kind of double game. On the one hand, as again you suggested, claiming they had no control, and on the other hand, facilitating the outrages that the settlers were perpetrating, which included leaving notes on people's on West Bank Palestinians' cars, which read, "Leave or we will kill you." And that, I think, represents the core passion of ethnic cleansing. Tries to portray ethnic cleansing as the lesser tragedy and compares it in effect to genocide, so that if a subjugated people fear genocide, they will choose the lesser option of leaving. And that's what Palestinians did in 1948 and again in 1967. What the Palestinians call by the Arabic name Nakba, which translates as catastrophe.
Professor, help us understand, too, what kind of conversations are taking place among the royal families of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, or even in countries like Tunisia or Morocco or Sudan that have relatively recently opened diplomatic relations with Israel, have not broken them in light of the war in Gaza. How do these families and governments justify continuing diplomatic relations with Israel with this treatment of Palestinians when you would think they would be natural defenders of the Palestinians?
Yes, it's a great disappointment, I think, to the Palestinians that they haven't received real support from their Muslim brothers and sisters. I think the explanation why they haven't received support is that the regimes in almost every one of these countries is afraid of its own population and needs the support of the U.S. and the West in order to feel politically secure. And so on the one side, it fears a movement like the one associated with Hamas and Islamic Jihad against in the taking the form of a second Arab Spring. And the desire on that, their part to please the U.S. and indirectly Israel. They're dependent, some of these countries are dependent on Israel for arms exports and a variety of undisclosed interactions, including the unified posture against Iran in its present political makeup and theological identity. Israel and the leading Arab countries oppose and fear the Iranian influence in the region. And so that creates a kind of transactional bond between Israel and its Arab neighbors. But as you say, the cost of pursuing such a pragmatic policy is to betray their own ethical and legal commitments to a lawful and morally acceptable policy.
Professor, you've been around for a long time. As we said, your birthday was recently, and you turned 95 years old. You've seen American politics over a great number of decades. We seem to have the most pro-Israel administration in history governing the country right now. Do you see this as a pendulum that goes back and forth, or is this the policy of the United States and it shall remain the policy of the United States? We've chosen our side and we're going to cede leadership on the human rights issue to anybody else who wants it. How do you see this?
Well, I think I differ somewhat with your initial point of departure that this is the most pro-Israeli government in history. I don't think on the scale of real pro-Israeli commitments, the Biden presidency was not so substantially different than Trump. It was more predictable. See, Trump is kind of unreliable and pursuing a kind of narcissistic geopolitics, which is very unstable from an Israeli point of view. They don't. They think they can manipulate Trump and have succeeded, I think, in the shaping of this so-called peace plan. But they, if they were prudent, they would be scared to place all their eggs in that basket. Trump is very mercurial, and if he sees that he can get a better economic deal with the Arab countries by endorsing a Palestinian state or by doing something that departs from the position of unconditional support, he's quite likely to do it in a way that, for instance, Biden wouldn't be likely to do. And one change is in the domestic scene. The Zionist lobbies are less formidable after this genocidal experience. And they don't have the at least silent acquiescence of the broader society. Their view, the relationship with Israel is no longer viewed as a positive aspect of American foreign policy. Now, American foreign policy, except in a condition of some kind of wartime, doesn't affect the voting behavior of most Americans that are influenced by what happens domestically rather than internationally. And that seems to be a continuing characteristic.
Should Americans have any reason to think that that this policy will change, regardless of who ends up in the White House, regardless of which party controls either of the two chambers of Congress? Is this just something that we have to expect to tolerate, or do you think there's a real possibility for change in American policy in the Middle East?
I think there's enough uncertainty that now exists that it's worth trying to exert additional pressure to make this change seem less politically costly to members of Congress that I think weren't genuinely so pro-Israeli as much as they feared the consequences for their own careers of blatantly opposing what the pro-Israeli lobby was seeking and demanding. I think that lobby, as I suggested, has much less leverage than it used to have. And there's a stronger case for at least departing from this position of outright complicity with what Israel is doing. And whether Trump, in all his involvement with trying to take credit for everything and attach his name to all kinds of international and national developments, whether he comes to be disillusioned about the prospects for his plan being realized in Israel, and then what happens after that happens. I'm not sure Israel is so crazy about having America run Gaza, and it interferes to some degree with their own plans, which are, I think, to occupy the whole of Gaza, at least indirectly, and to have undisputed rights to claim the offshore natural gas deposits, which are considerable, apparently, and didn't exist earlier when Israel was more worried about the demography of keeping Gaza than it was about the political and economic consequences of allowing it to affiliate with Jordan or possibly even Egypt or become autonomous. It was much readier for that because of its demographic fears of a majority Palestinian population in Israel. And it on the one hand, wanted to annex the Palestinian territories. On the other hand, it wanted to keep a Jewish majority population so it could have at least the appearance of being a political democracy.
Professor, last question. I want to return to the Canada issue for a moment. Were you able to get to your conference? Were you able to speak your piece? Did they treat you with respect? And did you have any problems leaving Canada?
It was part of the strangeness of the experience when they finally did let us enter. They then completely forgot about us and the conference. And there was no problem. I never in all my years of traveling had so little problem entering the U.S. as I did this time. They absolutely didn't look at our passports. It was very peculiar. And Canada had no interest in our, when we departed, they didn't ask a single question, where had we been or what had we done. So it was something that happened that is a missing part in the puzzle, because I think that maybe, see, the people who were arranging this tribunal had some influence of their own, and when they heard we were having this trouble, they tried to put pressure on the Prime Minister's office to do something. And I had, as a former student, Lloyd Axworthy, who had been the foreign minister of Canada and much respected public figure, and they knew that I was close to him, and he also intervened and proposes to write something about the situation, which he considers also to have been an outrage.
Well, I'm glad. And I'm glad you got in and got out in one piece. Professor Richard Falk, thanks for joining us. Professor Falk is an American professor emeritus of international law. That's at Princeton University. He's Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor's chairman of the Board of Trustees, and he's the former special rapporteur for human rights with the United Nations. Thanks so much for being with us. Great to see you again.
Good. Thank you for having me, John. I enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, I always enjoy them as well. Thanks for taking the time.
Good. It was well worth it.
All the best.